We're speaking with Alan Johnson, who's an author, novelist, a sociologist, and public speaker, who will be speaking in Kalamazoo at Western Michigan University on the subject of unraveling the knot of race. And with me is WMUK's Earlene McMichael. Mr. Johnson, you've made a study of race and gender issues, and you seem to link many of the problems we have in those two areas with the term you use, privilege. What do you mean by privilege?
The most important thing about privilege is that it is something that is socially conferred on people. In other words, in order to benefit from it, people have to identify you as belonging to a particular category. So in general, privilege is any advantage that is unearned and that is exclusive to a particular group of people. So white privilege would be unearned advantages that are available to people who are identified as white. And that part is the socially conferred part that's critical. People have to, when they look at you, when they perceive you in some way, they have to put you in that category. If they don't, then you're not, in that moment, you're not eligible for white privilege.
And so what is an example, a concrete example of white privilege?
A concrete example would be, for example, in hiring situations. And there, many people believe that these kinds of incidents are in the past. And every time people go out and do research, they find out that, no, they're quite prevalent. When white people get interviewed for jobs, there is usually an unconscious assumption that a white person is competent, for example, unless they show themselves to be less than competent. People of color tend not to get that benefit of the doubt. So for people of color, very often, a lot of these assumptions are unconscious. The assumption is that they're probably not going to be very competent unless they surprise us with how articulate they are, how knowledgeable they are, and so on. So repeatedly, what studies find is that people of color and white people who apply for the same jobs with the same qualifications, people of color are significantly less likely to get called back, to get offered jobs, or if they are offered jobs, to be offered comparable salaries. So there is a tremendous amount of discrimination that goes on based upon the perception that white people are generally superior to people of color.
The topic of privilege definitely can make people's back go up and get defensive. You used words talking about unearned advantage. That definitely could get people's hairs up on their head. How is it that you could persuade people about the presence of privilege?
Well, there are a couple of things that I think are important. The first is that privilege is not something that we have as individuals. It's not like it's a possession, like, you know, your car or the shirt you're wearing. And so having privilege is not something that people typically are conscious of. So that when I, for example, walk down a street in a city and I am not stopped by police, I'm not aware of the fact that I'm not being stopped. I'm just walking down the street. But people of color, especially in cities, all the time have these experiences of being stopped by police for no other reason than that they're people of color and the police are looking for something and they target them in ways that they do not target white people. So in that moment, I'm enjoying an advantage in relation to people of color. The advantage is that I'm simply allowed to pass by, unmolested, unchallenged. But I'm not going to be aware of that unearned advantage unless something happens to make me aware of it, whereas people of color are aware of it all the time. So it becomes, in a sense, the default is for people in dominant groups to have no awareness of the unearned advantages that they have, to simply think that's just the way it is. I go out and walk down the street, I walk down the street. What's so remarkable about that? So when somebody then says to them, well, you're enjoying unearned advantages, then people can say, I don't know what you're talking about. And they're being honest. They don't know what you're talking about much of the time. And that's the way systems of privilege are organized. There are also a lot of, the second point I want to make is that there are many categories of people in the United States, especially around social class, who struggle tremendously their whole lives. And so to say to them, well, you're on the receiving end of some kind of advantage, when their experience of their own lives is just the opposite of having no advantages at all, doesn't go over very well. But the fact is that working class people of color, for example, they've got to deal with class disadvantage in the same way that whites do. But on top of that, they have to deal with the disadvantages that come with being identified as being of color. And if you've struggled all your life and you're white, that's a hard thing to see. And there were times in our history when white people in the working class especially did see that and realized that they had a great deal in common with people of color in relation to the class system. And so that at one point, white labor unions started allowing people of color into the unions because they realized that they had a great deal in common with people of color, that people of color were not their enemy.
You've written a book called Privilege, Power, and Difference, where you outline this whole idea of privilege. Tell us, what can we learn from that book?
I think one of the most important things that I try to develop in all the work that I do around these issues is that we are participating in something larger than ourselves, what sociologists call social systems. Families are systems. Western Michigan University is a system. Kalamazoo is a system, and so on. And all of our lives, all the time, we are participating in these various systems. And they shape, our participation shapes our experience, our perceptions, and our behavior. And the example that I give is the game of Monopoly. And the game of Monopoly is one where it's organized in a particular way. It lays down what I call paths of least resistance, which basically is this is how you're supposed to play the game. And it produces certain outcomes. And the outcome of the game of Monopoly is an outcome, you could choose any game for this example, but that's the one I've been using for years. The outcome of the game of Monopoly is a greedy outcome. One person has everything, right? And everyone else has nothing. And you could say, well, if you were from another planet and you were watching people play this game, and you would think, why would people do this? What kinds of people would try to take everything for themselves? In other words, the explanation would be in terms of the people. The outcome is greedy because they must be greedy people. But we all know that you don't have to be greedy in order to play Monopoly and produce that outcome. That's where the game goes every single time, as long as most people play by the rules. And that's the way social life works in families, in workplaces, everywhere. We are participating in things larger than us, and we can be wonderful, decent, moral, well-intentioned individual people, but we can participate in systems that, like the game of Monopoly, are organized in ways that if everybody sort of does what they're supposed to do, it can produce terrible consequences.
If we become aware that there are those rules to the game of life, if you will, and privilege exists, is that enough to, as you say, unravel the knot of race or gender or whatever inequalities we may have in our society?
I have never encountered historically an example of a major system of privilege that changed simply because people read about it or became aware of it. Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, said once that power does not yield except by demand. And I can't think of an example where that hasn't been true.
So how do we, in this case, unravel the knot of race?
Well, I think the most important thing is, of course, awareness is part of this. So if we don't know where we are, then it won't occur to us that we might want to change the way things are. So awareness is a big piece of it, but it's only the first step. And the second step, I think, is to organize. If we're trying to change social systems, we can't do it one person at a time. A lot of times I hear people in audiences say, what can I do? And I often respond, you need to change the question. The question is, what can we do? So we need to work together in order to identify what it is about the systems that we participate in. It might be a workplace or a university. What is it specifically about how privilege manifests itself in that place that we want to change? And then the work of analysis, of organizing, of strategizing, that's how it happens. That's how the civil rights movement worked. That's how the gay, lesbian, transgender, how that movement worked, the women's movement, the labor movement. Every social movement is only as powerful as its analysis. We have to come to an understanding of what is it that needs to be changed, how does it work, what are the forces that keep it in place, and where can you insert the lever to exert pressure for change. Every social movement has had to come to those kinds of understandings in order to be effective. And that continues to be the challenge.
You give the impression that the biggest amount of change is going to happen at the institutional level and at the societal level and not at the individual level. Some organizations may feel ill-equipped to handle this kind of change or navigate this. What would you suggest? Is this just diversity training? What is the next tangible steps look like for an institution?
Well, I think we need to start where we are, and where we are is in a state of tremendous silence and denial. It's very hard to find any place in the United States where there are ongoing public conversations that use words like privilege or racism. We have been silenced in this country around these issues for a long, long time. And every time they come up, there's this big, all this heat and all this anger and defensiveness to try to make it go away. And that's what we're stuck in. So to me, the first step is to break the silence. And we need to start naming things for what they actually are. I don't use the word diversity in my work. I think it's a euphemism that was invented pretty much by corporations so they wouldn't have to look at the reality of things. The word diversity suggests that human beings have a problem with people who are different from us. And if you look at the history of human contact with people who are really different from them, it's not true. We're fascinated by people who are different than us. People go out of their way long distances to encounter people who are really different from them. Look at small children. They are always into stuff that's new. That's not the problem. Variety of human beings is not the problem. Systems of privilege are the problem. Race is something that literally does not exist. It doesn't exist genetically. It doesn't exist biologically. The biologists, the scientists say there's no such thing as from a scientific point of view. It's completely made up. And it was made up. If you look at the history of the idea of whiteness, for example, it's only several hundred years old. The idea of whiteness was literally invented by Europeans as a way to justify the exploitation of people of color, especially in Africa and South America. I think we need to stop talking about diversity. We need to start talking about equity. We need to start talking about privilege. And we need to start talking about oppression, which is a consequence of privilege. And that's the beginning. And my experience is that once we change the conversation so that it is speaking the reality of what we're living in, then we're not going to have a problem seeing what needs to be changed. We're going to see it all around us.
Do you think the conversation is heading in the right direction in this country?
I don't see that. I don't see that. I would love to believe that it is, and maybe I'm just not, exposing myself to the right sources of information, but I don't think so. I think the mass incarceration of people of color in the United States is continuing. I don't hear anybody at the federal level, for example, or at the state level coming out and saying, we have to stop this now. We are literally stuffing prisons and jails with people of color for offenses, drug offenses, which most of which are committed by whites. Something like 85% of the illegal drug offenses in the United States, buying, selling, and using, are committed by white people. Because most of the people in the United States are white people. But most of the people being arrested for that crime, being targeted for that crime in the so-called war on drugs, are people of color. And that's continuing. And it's catastrophic, not only for individuals, but for families, for neighborhoods, for communities. To have a community where everybody knows somebody who's in jail, who then gets out of jail and can't get a job because they have a record now, because they got stopped and frisked and the cop found a joint in their pocket. I mean, this is a devastating thing that's ongoing in the United States. And it's only one of many. I mean, the financial collapse in 2008 had a terrible consequences for the white population, but the consequences for people of color were orders of magnitude larger than that, the loss of homes, regardless of income level.
It sounds like a very dismal state of affairs right now. Are you optimistic at all that there could be some change? Obviously, you're staying in the game and you keep promoting this issue and change. So are you feeling a sense of optimism? Are you optimistic that things might change?
I don't like the word optimism. I go with the idea that nobody knows enough to be either pessimistic or optimistic. I have no idea what's coming. I mean, global warming by itself is already happening. And unless we do something about this fairly soon, the scientists are really clear about where this is going to go, where it is going. So do I feel optimistic that the governments are going to come around and find a way to address these things? No. I don't see reasons for optimism about race and about privilege and oppression in the United States, about violence against women, I don't see reasons to be optimistic, to think, well, this is going to work itself out. I would like that to be true, but I can't see an actual concrete reason to believe it's true. I proceed on faith, by which I mean not that I believe that this is going to work itself out, but that I believe that our job at this time, in these really difficult times, our jobs as citizens is to act without fear as much as we can, to identify what's wrong and to work together towards something better. Do I think that's going to happen? I don't know. I don't know anybody who does. And I would like to, and I know people want to hear, well, this is going to somehow work itself out. I don't know. It may not. It may not. It certainly is not going to work out unless we do something. Some superhero is not going to, you know, jump in here and save us. We're going to save us, or we're not. I think that the most dangerous thing that I see in this country, in the world in many ways, is the human capacity not to live in reality. The financial collapse just before it happened, all over the world, people were convinced that you could run a global economy on debt that would never have to be repaid, that you could have an economic system that allowed incredibly reckless gambling on an enormous scale. You had everybody from presidents to bankers and ordinary citizens who all thought, well, that will work. And now we look back on that and we think, well, that was insane. I mean, that was really crazy. And it was disastrous. So I'm really struck by all of our capacity to live in unreality and think that it's real. And what a dangerous place that is to be. So my sense is that the real challenge facing us is to wake up.
We've been speaking with Dr. Alan Johnson, who is an author, a sociologist, and a public speaker on issues related to gender and race. He'll be speaking here at Western Michigan University on Thursday, September 19th, beginning at 5:30 p.m. in the Multicultural Center at Trimpey Hall. Dr. Johnson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.